Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. The James Webb Space Telescope is now fully operational and doing amazing science. We'll talk to three guests about the early science and amazing images coming out of NASA from the JWST. Later on in the show, we'll visit with a deputy manager for the telescope, Ritva Keski-Kua, and then we'll chat with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Mike Ressler, who was part of the design and building of the mid-infrared instrument that has helped create some of the stunning first images. But before we introduce our first guest, I'd like to welcome back physics professor at California State University, Chico, and an astronomer in her own right, Kendall Hall, who will be co-hosting this episode with me.
It's great to be back. Thank you so much for having me again.
Well, last time we were together talking about the James Webb Space Telescope, it was before it was in orbit, but now that it's successfully operating out there, I just want you to share with us, you know, why is this important to you? What is it about the James Webb Space Telescope that piques your interest as a professional?
That is such a great question. JWST is going to be great for so many subfields in astrophysics. And for mine in particular, I study star formation and the formation of dust and gas. And James Webb Space Telescope sees into the infrared. So it sees longer wavelengths of light, which can more easily escape these dense, dusty gas environments, which means that it's a lot easier to see what I'm actually studying. So that's sort of the gist of why I'm excited, is this sort of unprecedented resolution in these wavelengths that allow me to do my science.
Well, with that, let's get to our first guest, Michelle Thaller. Michelle is an infrared astronomer and science communicator for the James Webb Space Telescope, which is managed and controlled by the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Michelle, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, great to be here.
Okay, the first question I have is, it was really fun to watch the unveiling of the first images the other day, and lots of people were watching excitedly, and you were the host of that, which was really fun. Tell me how you got that gig.
Ah, you know, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's not a really simple answer to that. So I've been doing science communication ever since I was at the Spitzer Science Center at Caltech.
Yes.
And that was, I got there in 1998. And I originally had thought I would just be sort of a straight academic astrophysics postdoc. That's why I'd come to Caltech. But the mission needed somebody to organize the education and outreach program. And NASA had new requirements. They wanted to make sure that everybody, all the major missions had, you know, full up communication plans and budgets and all of that. And so someone kind of said, well, hey, let's throw that to Michelle. She sort of likes those things. And that became my, you know, the work that I did to support the mission became more communications oriented. So to tell you the truth, I always feel a little insecure about this because, you know, I'm not a professional television host. You know, I'm always thinking, I don't look like the type of person that should be here, you know, whatever. I mean, we all have our versions of imposter syndrome. But I think the thing that I do bring is that when you have somebody who's hosting the television show, even if they're not the experts that you're featuring, I find myself very comfortable talking to them, you know, kind of knowing what question might come next. You know, when you have technical snafus like we did that day, like, you know, hey, let's talk to Canada. They're not here. You know, I mean, I immediately just, you know, took the scientist that we were going to interview next and started talking about, you know, the result. And so I think there is some real value to having somebody that's both kind of the communication host, but who knows enough about the subject matter that they can sort of, you know, give some narrative to the show. And so I guess that's why they keep asking me back.
Well, speaking selfishly, I certainly hope that's the case.
Oh, thank you.
You know, the worldwide reaction to these images has been fantastic.
Yes.
What do you think of that?
It surprised even me. I mean, I knew people were anxiously awaiting the web. I mean, that's great. But I didn't expect us that night to be like the background for a Coldplay concert. I mean, seriously, that night, the images were featured in a Coldplay concert, Cirque du Soleil, in their show in Las Vegas, Love, you know, that they're Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. They changed the video to actually feature the web images. I mean, that happened the day that they were released. You know, New York Times front page 2 days in a row doesn't suck. I mean, it was touching. I mean, it always makes you think, wow, maybe people, you know, do really appreciate some of this work that we do. I mean, it was wonderful.
Yeah, it was spectacular to see. And speaking of this worldwide reaction, I just want to take a moment to Admittedly, I was not born when Hubble released their first images. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering if you remember sort of the first image release of Hubble, whether the disappointing one because the mirror was, you know, not quite aligned, or, you know, was it the wrong shape, or whether this compares to the release of the actual corrected Hubble images. You know, how does this compare?
So I was alive when the first Hubble images were released. I believe I was in college, and I had been following sort of all of these, you know, delays and over budgets. Is this thing going to work? You know, and then of course, most tragically, you know, we had the disaster with the Challenger space shuttle, and that delayed it further. So I remember, you know, this sort of shock and disappointment that the images were not in focus. The strange thing, and the thing that hardly anybody talks about, is that the spectrograph still worked wonderfully. So, you know, I mean, I'm an astronomer, and most of the work we do is looking at spectra, at the light spread out into a rainbow. You look very carefully at exactly how much light is coming in each color, and that's how you find out what the stars are made of, how hot they are, how far away galaxies are. So, I mean, in some ways, for me as a scientist, the Hubble started doing very good work right away, you know, but then there's all the excitement of, you know, can we repair it? Is this going to happen? And when they finally did release things, I mean, so yes, I certainly remember the original Pillars of Creation. It just, you know, it blew our socks off. The universe being so colorful, so clear. And, you know, and then as you followed on with things like the first Hubble Deep Field, which, you know, people forget what a controversy that was. You know, the idea of using that much time, you know, I mean, you know, astronomers will fight for literally seconds of time on you know, the Hubble Space Telescope or the Webb. And it's like, oh yeah, we'll look at a patch of sky that we don't see anything in for a month. And I mean, that was very, very controversial. But I still get goosebumps looking at the Hubble Deep Field. You know, when you think about the fact that in, you know, a grain of sand held at arm's length, we found thousands of galaxies we hadn't seen before. So, I mean, these images, you know, I'm not sure they're as much of a step up from Hubble as Hubble was from the things that came before. But the real thing that people, again, I think sometimes forget, is that this is different light. This is invisible light. You know, the galaxies we see are even farther away. Even if they look similar to a Hubble Deep Field, they're actually seeing much farther because they're in infrared. You know, these images of the Carina Nebula, they're beautiful. Just the Hubble image is beautiful too. But we're seeing farther into the nebula, farther into the star-forming regions. So it's not so much that the images are so much more dazzling, but the scientific information and the context of them is so dramatic that you're seeing, you know, farther into the past, farther into these stellar nurseries. You're seeing things you can't see.
Could you dive just a two sentences a little bit about how this is, you know, seeing further into clouds?
Oh, yes, sure. So there are three huge advantages to an infrared telescope. You know, first one, you can see things that are warm but don't happen to be glowing hot. You know, so a star is glowing hot, gives off visible light, but, you know, cold dust, you know, around a solar system, you know, no, that doesn't glow. But an infrared light, you can detect it because it's warm. And then the second huge advantage is that you can actually see through obscuring dust. And this is actually why most fire departments have infrared cameras. It's not to see the hot fire. They got that, you know, but if you go into a smoke-filled room and you have infrared goggles, it's like the smoke isn't there. You can see where people are trapped. You can see what's going on. And just like that in space, infrared is very good at going through obscuring dust. And there are things like, you know, stars form and planets form inside giant clouds of dust. Huge black holes usually have big dusty environments around them. There's wonderful things to see that are often behind obscuring dust. And then the last huge advantage is that you really can see farther away because, you know, light waves get stretched out by the expansion of space. And so the more space light has to travel through, the farther and farther it gets stretched out. It actually loses energy. And so, you know, some light that might have started when the star emitted it, it was visible light or maybe even ultraviolet light. By the time it's traveled through, you know, billions of years, traveling through an expanding universe to get to us, it's been shifted all the way out of visible into the infrared. And so you literally can see farther into the universe and therefore farther back in time.
Really cool. Yeah. It always blows my mind that, you know, how far light has to travel has something to do with it stretching out. It's just such a cool concept.
And that's actually one of the ways we estimate how far away these galaxies are, because we can see very well how stretched out the light is. There are, you know, signatures, you know, fingerprints of atoms like hydrogen or helium or carbon. And I know one of the ones we saw was neon, you know, in some of these new images. And we know exactly where those fingerprints should be. And then when we see them at a much lower energy, we go, aha, you know, they must have had to go through that much space in order for it to stretch that much. So it's a great way to measure the distance to the galaxies.
Yeah, it's just wonderful. Could you speak just very quickly about, you know, how JWST is performing? I mean, it looks like it's performing, you know, better than people could have imagined.
It's actually performing better than our requirements. Yes. So, you know, we had sort of this idea about how well things would perform given a certain amount of background electronic noise, you know, the way any kind of, you know, electronic camera works. And once we got it up there and everything checked out, the noise levels are actually lower than we expected. Things are focusing beautifully. So in plain English, yes, it's actually working a little better than we'd hoped.
Well, and, you know, also from the standpoint of people who've been on this project for many, many years, launch is always, you know, stressful. That needs to go well. But there was that checkout period of deployment that was just, you know, had to be very nerve-wracking for everyone on that team. And now to be to the point where you can release these wonderful images to the public, it just must be a feeling of triumphant relief and satisfaction.
I'm gobsmacked. Launch itself, you know, the Ariane 5 rocket is a very, very good rocket. And so, you know, I think a lot of us were like, you know, okay, cool, launch, great. But the real tension, the real anxiety came in the 2 weeks after. And, you know, there were nearly 350 things that you had to send a signal to say, okay, go and do that. Now do this, now do this. And if any one of those had not worked, the telescope could have been lost. I mean, the mission would not work. And the thing was, it started to go so perfectly. And there was a rush. Again, I don't think people really understand this, that as it was moving out towards its final location, a million miles away from the Earth, it was cooling down. That's good. We wanted the telescope to operate pretty close to 400 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. But the all of these little engines and pulleys and pins, they're going to work better if things are a little bit warmer. Right. I mean, we didn't want everything to sort of freeze up. And of course, yes, the motors had little heating elements in them, but everything was going to be easier to move while it was warm. And so as soon as that thing acquired its own power, you know, and a solar panel, you know, deployed and it was getting electricity, we were like, bang, bang, do this, do this, do this, do this, do this. And it just didn't stop because everything kept working perfectly. It's like, okay, do that. That worked. Great. Do the next thing. Okay. That worked. Great. Great. Do the next thing. So, you know, literally after about 2 or 3 days of everything going perfectly, people were just exhausted and they sent everybody home to get a good night's sleep. And then we'll pick this up tomorrow morning because, you know, we figured there'd be some snag, there'd be some problem we'd have to work out. And instead it just worked. I can't say it enough. It just worked perfectly.
There's no Murphy out at that Lagrange point, evidently.
Nothing. Oh. Nothing went wrong. Oh, I mean, we had all these wonderful things that we, of course, you know, if this doesn't work, we're going to try this. You know, if it doesn't deploy right, well, maybe we can rotate the spacecraft and that'll kind of, you know, throw it out a little bit. I mean, we had all these plans and it was so fun to just keep tearing them up. It's like, okay, contingency plan for that, rip. Literally. I mean, in some cases, people were actually literally cheering and ripping up, you know, paper printouts of plans for when things went wrong. And, you know, oh, next thing, rip, yay. You know, I mean, what a thing to be part of over 2 weeks.
Wow, ripping up a contingency plan just seems such a cathartic thing to do.
Yes, like I said, I mean, I was not the lead engineer on these things. I wasn't the one ripping, but in some cases I was watching. And yeah, it's amazing when you say, yep, we don't need that anymore.
Oh, yeah. So you spoke about the deep field image of Hubble, you know, and how sort of ridiculous it was to point at this blank portion of the sky. But maybe let's talk about these images that were just released from JWST. And the first one was that deep field image that was first released by President Biden during this press release.
That's right. Yes. And we let him choose the image. You know, we this all was last minute. And of course, it gave us some wonderful public notice. So no complaints. But we got sort of this call from the White House just a few days before we were going to release the images. And, you know, Biden would like to release something. I mean, we had this whole script written out. You know, we had this whole show. It's like, you know, we had different experts that were going to talk on this. And so we didn't know which one he was going to pick. And we didn't know what, because we wanted, of course, to lead with that one, because that would be the one that people had seen before. But yeah, so that deep field, this is what really kind of in a good way scares me about the Webb telescope, is that was not a long exposure. You know, whereas Hubble had spent, you know, the better part of a month looking in the same part of the sky to do some of these deep fields. And even with more sensitive cameras, you know, the latest deep field that it did, you know, took a couple of weeks. This was a 5-hour exposure. So, I mean, this was something that we did to sort of test out and make sure that all of our deep imaging cameras were working right. But as Jane Rigby, one of the lead scientists, said, I mean, this is something that we did before lunch. And we can do this many times a day. And in a 5-hour time frame, we have now the farthest galaxy that we have information, a spectrum about. It's not technically the farthest tiny little pixel we've ever seen, but this was 5 hours. And it's now the farthest galaxy that we know the chemistry of, what it's made of, you know, a good measurement of how far away it is, all of that. That's incredible, because so what happens when we actually do a week-long exposure or a month-long exposure? What are we going to see? Because 5 hours gives you the equivalent of what Hubble, when it was young, could do in a month.
Ooh, that's almost scary.
Like I said, it's scary in a good way. This is giving me goosebumps right now. That's scary. Think about what we're going to be able to see. And all of the early release observations were like that. They were relatively short exposures. We knew people wanted us to get the data out quickly. We knew that the space programs, the governments, you know, it's like, you know, as soon as you guys have something good, you know, we really want you to release it fast. So we didn't have time to do giant mosaics of big nebulas or, you know, very, very deep fields that took, you know, days to take. This is what, and I mean, not disparaging, but this is what you get when you're doing quick and dirty, you know. And already, each one of those images must be worth dozens of scientific papers. That's astounding.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as Kendall Hall and I continue our conversation with NASA astronomer Michelle Faller as we talk about the early science coming out of the James Webb Space Telescope. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's rejoin the conversation that my co-host Kendall Hall and I had with NASA astronomer Michelle Faller as we talk about the first pictures in science from the James Webb Space Telescope.
Yeah, I was looking into one of the images, the image of the Southern Ring Nebula, which is that mm-hmm. beautiful, you know,
yes.
Sort of almost figure eight shaped nebula called a planetary nebula. And it's got all of these layers and different colors. And I saw this really interesting sort of thread about papers that have been published about this nebula. And it's been really interesting because a planetary nebula is, you know, the death of a lower massed star. Its outer layers just sort of float away. That's what makes a quote unquote planetary nebula. It has nothing to do with planets.
That's right.
But yes. This nebula, this planetary nebula, is particularly interesting because even before we had telescopes that could resolve such a thing, it was predicted that this one was not just one star, but it was a binary star system, two stars, right, that are gravitationally influencing each other. Mm-hmm. And JWST released this image where you can actually resolve the distance between these two stars, clearly see both of them.
So the reason we couldn't see the other component of the binary star is that that was the star that had died, that had, you know, created this beautiful nebula, just like you said, that, you know, when stars like our sun die, first they bloat up, you know, to be really big, and then the outer layers just kind of drift away. And you sort of watch a star unravel itself back into space. And with it come all these wonderful chemicals, that things like carbon and oxygen and the building blocks of life. So, you know, the reason we couldn't see that other star before was because all that was left was something called a white dwarf, which is just the tiny dead little core of the star. So you go from something that is as big as the sun's so big you could fit a million Earths inside it. And a white dwarf is about the size of the Earth. So it's just the dead little dense center of the star that's left. And all it's doing is cooling off. There's no more nuclear reactions. It's not generating any more energy. It's just, it was hot because it used to be the center of the star, and it just is cooling off. And so these things are very small. And the reason you don't see them in visible light, I mean, even though they're hot, I mean, their surfaces can be as hot as 100,000 degrees. It's just the size of the Earth. It's the size of like a, you know, of a planet. So it's just like a very hot planet. And so visible light wise, they just don't give off much light. But in infrared, so, I mean, here's the thing. Infrared is sensitive to heat. And, you know, infrared is sensitive to things that are warm, glowing. And so in infrared, this thing's pouring out a lot of heat, even though it's a small thing. And so there were two images of a southern ring, one taken in the near infrared. And in the near infrared, you don't really see the binary star. It's very much like just a very red image. Near infrared is sort of like the color red, but just a little more red than we can see. But when you go out to mid-infrared, and then this was the MIRI, the mid-infrared imager observation. When you go out to mid-infrared, this is where things become like a night vision camera. Things that are warm actually glow, actually give off light that the telescope picks up. And so I loved seeing that binary. And I was amazed to see, you know, how bright that tiny little dead core of a star was when you see in the infrared.
Let's go on to the next image. Let's talk about the amazing image of Stefan's Quintet, because that really blew my mind. Because I've seen that before through a backyard telescope, and it's pretty neat. But boy, nothing like that.
Yeah. And once again, I think with Stefan's Quintet, you really see the advantage of the infrared. So of the quintet, one of the galaxies is actually a little closer to us and not associated with the other four. But then four of the galaxies are actually coming together gravitationally, and they're merging together eventually to form one bigger galaxy. And we now understand that this is how galaxies like the Milky Way form. In the early universe, you know, you don't see any big galaxies, like beautiful big spirals. So there's this wonderful process of merging. Little galaxies come together to form bigger ones, and even pretty large galaxies like the ones in Stefan's Quintet, you know, they're coming together to form a super galaxy, an even bigger one. And so what you see in the infrared is you really see, you know, let me just say this, the visible, you're sort of blinded by all the starlight. Yeah, that's nice, all these stars shining. But in the infrared, you can see the underlying structure of the galaxy, the glowing dust, you know, how things really are being pushed and pulled by gravity, you know, how these galaxies internally are changing, being pulled apart and reassembled into this this bigger galaxy. So, I mean, to me, when you look at the infrared, it looks so different because you're seeing the underlying structure of the galaxy, what's really going on, not just where the bright stars happen to be.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, that image, I will say, maybe I'm just, you know, friends with more galactic astronomers, but that's the one that I see all over my Twitter feed, is just people in awe. So there's this last image, that famous Hubble image of the pillars of creation is. And so I've seen these videos of, you know, just you see the Hubble image and it zooms out and it's now this huge Davis T image. It's bigger, but with more resolution, right? So how are you feeling about this, and what information are we getting from it?
Absolutely. When we were selecting the early release observations, we didn't know exactly what time of year the launch would be. And that's really important because the James Webb Space Telescope always has to look away from the sun. That's why we have our wonderful heat shield. And so we can really only see, like, say, half the sky at a time because we can't look in towards the sun. That would destroy the telescope. So we had to come up with all of these observations. I think there were about 70 of them. You did your different ideas. Okay, well, what if we launch in February? What if we launch in December? You know, what if we launch in June? We're going to be seeing different parts of the sky. So I'm sure we will do the Pillars of Creation in the Eagle Nebula. I think that, but the Carina Nebula is gorgeous. It's another giant region of star formation. It's actually my favorite object to look at through a small telescope. The only complication is it's in the southern hemisphere, so you need to get down below the equator to see it. But, you know, there are hundreds of stars forming inside this giant cloud of dust and gas, lighting up the cloud. And once again, what Hubble mainly saw was the beautiful dust. gorgeous shapes of glowing dust. But in this image, we look inside the dust. And there are all of these whorls and structures and bubbles being blown by the heat and the particle winds of new stars turning on. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure that there are astronomers now going through that whole thing with a fine-tooth comb, trying to figure out what all that structure is and what's going on inside that cloud. We have a general idea how stars form. I mean, sure, you know, you have a lot of dust and hydrogen in a cloud. Parts of it become denser through gravity. Eventually, the denser bits heat up inside and you get stars. But we don't know, why do some clouds form really massive stars, like, you know, that are 50 times the mass of the sun, and others form stars that are only a tenth the mass of the sun? Why are some systems binaries or triple or quadruple systems of stars, whereas other stars like the sun are alone, apparently? So, you know, there's all kinds of questions we have about how the details of star formation, and therefore also planet formation, because all these, you know, young solar systems are forming there too. And I mean, now we have a chance to look inside and see how it's going. And it's also beautiful. It's just, I mean, that was the one where, when I saw it on the big screens behind us in the broadcast, it's like, that looks good. That looks so gorgeous, blown up into a giant image.
Yeah, it was really stunning.
It's amazing.
You know, it's funny. We're working on Spitzer. That was one of my favorite images, because Spitzer took a much, much larger picture of the Eagle Nebula, where you can see the pillars of creation, but then you see that's part of this huge complex of star formation. And so I love the Hubble image. And then I also love how the Spitzer image expanded it. And I'm sure the Webb will observe that as well.
Well, we're about out of time, but before we let you go, what can we look forward to next? Like, how often will we be seeing new images from Webb?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, we had more observations to pick from the early release set than we actually ended up releasing. We had more than five. So there are already other gorgeous images that are ready to go. And I don't think they will wait long. There are a number of big meetings coming up. There's the big engineering SPIE meeting. There's the big international COSPAR science meeting coming up in 2 weeks. I think some of those very well may be released for those events. I think that some of the things I'm really looking forward to is we do have some images of our own solar system, some of the giant planets. And I think that, you know, that would be wonderful to see what Webb can actually, you can routinely observe these big planets. I think that in the next year, you will see a spectrum of an Earth-like planet's atmosphere. You know, the first spectrum that was part of our early release observation was one of these big, hot Jupiter-like planets very close to its star. And it's cool. I mean, it's cool. Like, again, in a very short amount of time, we got a beautiful spectrum, absolutely gorgeous. The transit as that planet moved in front of its star and blocked out the light was so clean and well done. But I want to see that done for an Earth-like planet, your Earth-sized, Earth-temperature planet. And so I'm really looking forward to that coming up in the next year. And I think we will see even deeper into the universe. I mean, come on, if we can do that in 5 hours, I mean, give us at least a day.
It's been wonderful to hear about what you're excited about and really how perfect JWST is performing.
Oh, my family's been losing sleep for JWST probably for the last 15 years. And, you know, so many things that went wrong and so many problems that had to be overcome, and they were, and I cannot believe how well it's working. This is one of the great joys of my life. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I do remember the media reaction to the Hubble images, the first images that were not clear. And NASA got lambasted on late night television. They were the butt of jokes all over late night TV. It was a very embarrassing time for the agency. And this is the opposite of that. This is just redemption.
Thank you. And the best is yet to come. I have to emphasize over and over again, these were quick images. You just wait and see what comes up next.
Well, Michelle Thaler from NASA, NASA astronomer and science communicator extraordinaire. Great to have you on the show again. And Kendall Hall, astronomy physics professor at California State University, Chico. Thanks so much for joining me. It's really fun to talk about the first images from JWST.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you as well. Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks, Kendall.
Let's take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our look at the James Webb Space Telescope's first images and science. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Now joining guest co-host Kendall Hall and I is a NASA engineer at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Ritva Keskikua is the deputy manager for the optical telescope element of the James Webb Space Telescope. Ritva, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you.
And you are in charge, or one of the managers for the OTE, which is the optical telescope element. And so let me ask a very simple question. What exactly does optical telescope element mean?
It means the big golden mirror that has 18 segments. That's the primary mirror that you see in all the pictures. The secondary mirror, and then the aft optics assembly. So those items or optical components make the optical telescope element. And obviously, the mirror segments are mounted to a structure, and then there's a secondary mirror struts. So all the whole assembly is the optical telescope element.
Yeah, so the actual telescope part of the James Webb Space Telescope, so which, you know, that's pretty important.
Correct, exactly.
So Ritva, how did you get to become the deputy project manager for the optical telescope element? And then also, it looks like you helped to sort of design aspects of the mirrors. And I was hoping you could dive a little bit into sort of minutiae of that, that there's a lot of engineering that goes into just specifically creating the mirrors that can do these observations.
So I started working on JWST in the late 90s, and my role in the beginning was I was leading a team that was looking at how are we going to test this telescope, particularly when we have to go to cryogenic temperature. How are we going to do it cost effectively and time efficiently? And then at some point in the late 90s, the person who was the telescope manager at the time asked me to join, if I was interested in joining as a deputy telescope manager. And I was happy to do that. I mean, this is an exciting program. So that's how it all started. And I have been working on it for over 20 years. And what went, this is a really, the telescope portion as well as the whole observatory is very challenging. So we had to invent new technologies actually to be able to do that. So it was really exciting to be part of that process.
Would you speak a little bit on what those new technologies are?
On the telescope itself, we had three technologies. One is those lightweight beryllium mirrors that when they were fabricated, we removed like 93% of the material to make them really lightweight so that we could launch them to space. So that was one technology. The second one was the composite lightweight structure. That is that we have to demonstrate that it can actually survive the cryogenic operating environment as well as perform as we expect it to make this telescope a success. And then the third thing that was really an invention was how do we align these mirror segments so that it the primary mirror looks like it's one big monolithic mirror. So that's the wavefront sensing and control process that we developed to do all that.
Yeah, so JWST has this very characteristic shape, and it's because of all of these mirror segments. And I think that some of us are sort of wondering why hexagonal mirrors and why they have to be so many.
The hexagonal concept, as you can see, if you look at the primary mirror, is it's very packaging efficient, so to speak. So where you can put them next to each other, close to each other. If you had, for example, round segments, you would have lots of empty space that it would be basically impossible to make it look like a one big optical components. But this way, when they are hexagonal, you can kind of like get them really close to each other and get the right shape. So that was why they are that shape. Now, why the mirror needs to be that big, it's just that you need, for some of those faint objects, we are looking back in time to towards the Big Bang, like 3.5 billion years. So you need a large collecting area to be actually able to see the faint objects at that far out.
It's kind of like bees. They have, you know, beehives, honeycombs are shaped like that. It's like nature's elegant design, you know, in place here on the JWST.
That's correct.
Ritva, before we let you go, I'm just wondering, you know, how you feel seeing the public reaction, you know, in the news media and, you know, just around the world and on social media, that people are very excited about the first images coming out of JWST. What do you think about the reaction you're getting so far from these first pictures in science?
I'm really happy to see the reaction and all the interest that the general public has towards this program. Like I said already, it's a technological marvel, and the science it is going to produce and is just fabulous.
Well, Ritva Keskikua, congratulations on the success so far, and best of luck moving forward, and can't wait to see what's next coming out of JWST.
Neither can I, and thank you.
Finally, let's go to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and talk to Mike Ressler. He's the project scientist for one of the JWST's most important components, the Mid-Infrared Instrument, or MIRI. Mike Ressler, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Okay, before we go any further, explain what mid-infrared is.
Okay, so infrared light or infrared radiation is anything that has a wavelength longer than visible light. So to infrared astronomers like me, visible light has a wavelength of about half a micron. What we call the near infrared, there are three near infrared instruments on JWST. They work at wavelengths from 1 to 5 microns, so somewhat longer than visible light. But the mid-infrared instrument is sort of the next step to even longer wavelengths. And so we work from about 5 to 28 microns is about where the limit of our instrument is. So mid-infrared is just that wavelength. As it turns out, most room temperature objects emit most of their light in the mid-infrared, or sometimes it's called the thermal infrared. So that's that same wavelength range.
And then, of course, there's another instrument on James Webb for near-infrared. Can you talk a little bit about like the overlap there, and like what are some of the sweet spots for observations between the two?
Yeah, so there are actually three near infrared instruments: NIRCam, which is the main imaging device; NIRSpec, which is the big spectrometer; and then NIRIS, which does some specialty observations that kind of overlap between imaging and spectroscopy. So one of the things in the near infrared, it's hotter objects. You see a lot of light molecules, things like carbon dioxide and water ice. And it's where most galaxies that are still in the process of forming are going to emit most of their light, or at least where they will appear to be brightest. MIRI, because of the longer wavelengths, we can see some of the bigger molecules, although we still see a lot of carbon dioxide and water ice and things as well. But we'll also see cooler objects like planets around other stars. And we'll be able to see deeper into dust clouds where newborn stars are forming. So they're very complementary. We kind of extend what the near-infrared instruments are doing. Working together, we have a really powerful workhorse where we get everything from, you know, basically the far red wavelengths, you know, barely what your eyes can see. That's the where the near infrared instruments kick in, and then we work all the way out to 28 microns together.
And let's talk about the instrument itself, because, you know, James Webb Space Telescope has had a rather long kind of torturous path to get to where it is now, which is a magnificent place, and it's working beautifully. But could you tell us a bit about the development of this instrument and your role in it?
So In 1997, NASA issued a call for concept studies for instruments that would fly on the next generation space telescope. So some colleagues at INJPL put in to do one of those concept studies, and we were awarded the job to start that. And so for about 4 years, we worked on just, you know, what would a mid-infrared instrument look like, what would we'd like it to be able to do. And then in 2001, NASA decided that there would be a mid-infrared instrument, which was great news for us. It would also be a partnership between NASA and the European Space Agency. So some group representing NASA would be responsible for half the instrument, and representing the European Space Agency would be the other half. So JPL was selected to be the NASA center for the US half. And we were responsible for the detectors, you know, the actual light sensors in the instrument, the electronics that controlled those, as well as the cryo cooler that would actually get our instrument down to 6 Kelvin. Our European partners were from 24 astronomical institutes in 10 European countries, and they're primarily responsible for the optics, all the optics in the system, you know, kind of like the camera lens equivalent, and the structure. And so we did our piece, they did their piece, we bolted them together, and everything worked spectacularly well. But in terms of the overall development, we started working on MIRI, the instrument, in 2001. So it's been a long road to get here, but everything worked, as you said. It's really fantastic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about JPL's role in this, because it's kind of interesting that the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and you have this role with the James Webb Space Telescope. Talk a little bit about what the responsibilities are, like, you know, day to day there, what you do at JPL in terms of monitoring the instrument.
So back during the development phase, you know, we were responsible for the infrared detectors. And so we had a contract with Raytheon Vision Systems, who actually manufactured them. I was responsible for telling them what we needed. So I set the requirements. And so I worked closely with them to make sure that they were producing the detectors that we needed to make our instrument work. Meanwhile, a group of engineers here designed the electronics that would control them in flight. So they had to be very robust and reliable. And so, you know, there was a lot of manufacturing going on. We delivered our part of the instrument back in 2010 and 2011. The Europeans then integrated the detectors onto the optical bench. It's basically like putting the lens on your camera body if you have a digital SLR camera. And then from the time we delivered, then it was lots of testing. So the instrument was tested at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in England. Then the instrument got delivered to Goddard Space Flight Center, where it went through a number of other tests. And then it went to Houston for more tests, and then to Northrop Grumman, where it was bolted onto the spacecraft in preparation for launch. So since we delivered, we've still been involved in testing the instrument, making sure everything was operating properly, understanding how the instrument actually behaved. All instruments have their own little quirks, so it's a lot of understanding that and writing reports and you know, reporting on how things really behaved. And then the last 6 months after launch, we've been doing a lot of similar tests in flight, making sure that everything survived properly and that everything was performing as expected, or maybe even a little better expected, as it turns out. So it's, you know, it was originally, you know, all the manufacturing and then all the analysis, and that's still going. It takes a long time to get through all that properly.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your research interests, because you're also an astrophysicist. So what are the things that interest you?
So I'm primarily interested in how stars are formed and how they die. One of my little projects is to study binary stars. Most stars form in pairs, not single stars. And so, you know, I just like to understand what's going on. You know, stars form from clouds of gas and dust, and in the mid-infrared, we can see right down to where they're forming. And so, you know, I'd like to see these binaries as they're coming to be. On the other end, you know, when stars die, they run out of fuel and kind of implode. And so they blow off their outer layers. that form these very pretty objects called planetary nebulae. They have nothing to do with planets. It's just that they look like planets to William Herschel and the others that discovered them. And so, you know, just trying to understand, you know, what material is ejected as they die, because we often see dust that comes from these things, and that dust will later get incorporated into new stars. And so it's, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how the products of one star's death would eventually be incorporated into the new stars that I'm interested in on the other end. So those are a couple of things that I'm specifically interested in, and actually do have some time with JWST to do those observations.
Wow, that's really exciting. So I have two follow-up questions. And the first one is, could you just briefly explain why JWST is more fitting for your research, you know, longer wavelengths? I know we've been through this maybe a few times before, but it's nice for non-astronomers, just a refresh on that idea, why this telescope is better than, say, Hubble for many aspects of this research.
Yeah, so JWST has two big advantages for what I'm interested in. The first is the longer wavelength range. You know, Hubble is primarily visible wavelengths with a little bit of near-infrared capability. But the dust is so dense where the stars are forming that even in the near-infrared, we can't see directly to the stars. So you really have to go out to 10 microns or so to be able to see through the dust well enough to see what's going on. So I really do need the longer wavelengths than Hubble offers. There was another telescope that did work in the infrared called the Spitzer Space Telescope that launched in 2003 and did a lot of work on how stars form. The disadvantage, if you will, about Spitzer, it was a relatively small telescope. The primary mirror, the mirror that collects the light and focuses it into our instruments, was only 85 centimeters in diameter, so only 1/8 the size of JWST. So with the much bigger mirror, it gives us much better sensitivity, and it also gives us much better spatial resolution. So I'll be able to see things that are 8 times smaller with JWST than I could with Spitzer. So particularly for binary stars, which are relatively close together, Spitzer couldn't resolve them. It could only see them as one star, whereas JWST, I'll be able to see them as the two. So the longer wavelength coverage and the better spatial resolution are really what makes JWST so important to my research.
For those who are unfamiliar, a micron is a 1/1,000,000th of a meter. So, 1/1,000,000th of a meter would be 10 microns. And then my second question was whether you were going to be using the broadband camera, so seeing sort of all of these wavelengths at once in this sort of camera setting, or whether you were going to be using the spectrograph
right
for your research.
I'm actually using the spectrograph or the spectrometer for most of my work. It's very, very important to be able to break the light into a spectrum, into its component colors, because that gives us a lot of information about what material is present. So I mentioned that we can see molecules. So in these young binary stars, you know, I want to know, is there water ice present? We actually do see water all over the universe. So, you know, how much water ice is present? What about carbon dioxide, methane? We'll see methane around these things. And the kind of interesting thing is these molecules are all important building blocks for life. So JWST is not going to let us say, oh, there's life over here. But what it does show us is that the building blocks are present. And so it will be interesting to see if these building blocks are present in all environments where stars form, because planets form around those stars. And, you know, there's at least one planet around one star that has life on it. So it'll help us understand the environments that, you know, may or may not support life. So most of my work is with the spectrograph. There is one of my little projects where I'll be looking at a planetary nebula that turns out to be so large that I can get a spectrum of one part of the planetary nebula at the same time I'm getting a mid-infrared image of another part. And by cleverly taking spectra at different points around the planetary nebula, I'll actually end up with images of the entire nebula at the same time. So taking advantage of Mother Nature a little bit, but yeah, mostly spectroscopy, but a little bit of imaging, because some of these things are going to look really cool. You know, as we're finding out from the science that people are doing now, we can see things that we could just never, ever see before, and it's spectacular.
Well, Mike Ressler, project scientist for the Mid-Infrared Instrument, MIRI, on the James Webb Space Telescope, thanks for sharing some of this early science with us and your amazing work helping to create this instrument.
Thanks very much. Again, it was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks again to our guests. From the James Webb Space Telescope's Control Center at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, NASA infrared astronomer and science communicator Michelle Faller, and Ritva Keski-Kua, the Deputy Project Manager for the Space Telescope's Optical Telescope Element. And from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, Mike Ressler, Project Scientist for the Space Telescope's Mid-Infrared Instrument. You can learn more about the JWST and see the latest images at jwst.nasa.gov. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. If you missed or want to revisit an episode of Blue Dot, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at blue.nspr. The theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. I'm Dave Schlom, and for all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.